Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
Right now in Fast, bruised and battered, shares of First Republic getting pounded again while a number of regionals and the big banks seem to be showing signs of life. So it's now the time to step in and buy names in the sector. We'll debate that. Plus, Amazon slashing its workforce. CEO Andy Jassy announcing 9,000 additional job cuts today. This, of course, on top of the 18,000 the e-commerce giant laid off back in November. Should all the tech world brace for more belt tightening? And later, Foot Locker's fade despite bullish commentary about the company's renewed relationship with Nike. The stock dropping on a soft outlook. Is this another sign the consumer is pulling back, or is this just sneaker thing? I'm Melissa Lee. This is Fast Money. We're live at the Nasdaq Market Site. On the desk tonight, Tim Seymour, Karen Feinerman, Dan Nathan, and Julie Beal. And we start off with a rebound on Wall Street to kick off the week. The Dow jumping more than 380 points with just two components finishing in the red. The S&P and Nasdaq also closing near that day's highs. All this as the race to rescue the banking system continues. After another week of turmoil in the financial industry, Swiss regulators over the weekend engineering a forced takeover of Credit Suisse by rival UBS. Meantime, in the U.S., New York Community Bank agreeing to buy the assets of crypto lender Signature Bank for less than $3 billion. And the auction of Silicon Valley continues with First Citizens looking to make a fresh bid for the bank. And then there's this, a group of mid-sized banks making the bold move of asking the FDIC to insure all bank deposits for 2 years. The moves helping the financial sector start to rebound. The big bank and regional ETFs both seeing moves higher today. That wasn't all good news. Shares of First Republic falling another 47%. The latest development, JP Morgan is advising the company on strategic alternatives, including a potential capital raise. So with all this action in the sector, we wondered, let's put up the four box. Can we put up the four box? Because I'm going to ask the question here. Is it time to buy the banks? Show of hands. Raise your hand if you say yes, it is time to buy the banks.
Oh, boy.
Rickets. Well, they're not monoliths, though.
They are not monoliths. That's
they're not.
But in terms of regionals, would you step in?
Well, hold on. We're all sitting on our hands the way Jamie Dimon's sitting on his hands, the way
that's
that all
fair.
Of these other banks
might get a better shot.
Sitting on their hands.
Yeah. Got to get a better shot.
That's the question. But why, what are we sitting on our hands for? There's a note out of Baird. This is very interesting. He said, if not now, then when?
When to buy?
When, yeah. When would you buy the regionals?
This look, this is the time, and to the extent that, if anything, there's coming support in terms of confidence for the regional banks. We still don't know really what the costs are going to be, and those costs are cost of capital. We don't know what the regulatory environment's going to be. I think we'd be waiting a long time for the regulatory environment to change. So if you look at the times when banks have had this kind of a credit dislocation in history, this has typically been the time. If you look at what the BKX has done over the last 4 or 5 days, it's actually stabilized somewhat, really, from Wednesday. I mean, we've kind of traded in a range. I just still think we have information in terms of who's going to be forced into bed with who, et cetera, et cetera. No question to me that we are overdone in terms of the group and in terms of positioning and in terms of what was specific to the banks that had the duration mismatch, the funding mismatch, whatever you want to say, that's not the entire banking sector.
Julie, you're just shaking your head. No way, Jose, is what it looked like from you. Why?
You know, I just continue to not like banks. I think the hardest thing is really understanding their financial statements. There's so much opportunity to, you know, have things that are kind of hidden off-site. But the biggest problem that I have is that you basically require Dumbo's magic feather. You have to believe that it's going to be solvent. You have to believe that your deposits are always going to be there. And that's not a business model I like. I don't want to be dependent on other people's confidence. I want them to either have to buy my stuff or buy my services. Those are the types of businesses I'd much rather own.
Wow, Dumbo's magic feather. I mean, to some extent,
I didn't know what that is.
You don't know the story of Dumbo?
I know that
the little mouse is in his hat.
It's very sad in the beginning, and I think I just shut down.
You can fly, and Dumbo believes it so much.
That's how he learns the feather.
I figured out what the
well, just in case somebody out there doesn't have a toddler or a young child and doesn't know the story of Dumbo, which I didn't know 5 months ago.
And you think you don't learn anything on this show?
I know. The more you know, but I mean, to some extent, there is a magic feather element.
I believe there's more than a magic feather to the G-SIB banks. uh-huh. right? I believe that that the government feels that we absolutely need a financial structure that can be counted on. These are the eight. We're never letting them fail. And I think that that is enough. There's a different question of, do you want to buy the stock? Right. So I think that, as Tim said, we're still in a situation of uncertainty, a lot of flux. We don't know what, let's say the banks get their wish and they get this 2-year deposit insurance right. for free. I doubt they're getting it for free. They've got to pay something. Right. They've got to give up something, pay something, have more deposit, have more leverage, something. Mm-hmm. And we don't know what that is. So it's hard to figure out. I think that there'll be opportunities. I'm not quite sure. I mean, you see a lot of deposit flow out of these. I don't know how hard it is to get it back. Right. And I got to imagine that we know Bank of America got a bunch of deposits, and JP Morgan must have just been absolutely flooded with deposits. So things have changed a lot. I'd rather wait and buy things higher and more stable.
That's interesting. So rather buy them when you have more clarity. Buy them. Yeah. Right. And actually, that makes a lot of sense. When you think about what we just don't know about these, I mean, the fact that we've seen 5 bank equities here in the U.S. basically go to zero and no one's really stepped in. There's been some extraordinary measures to try to backstop them. There's been no buyers. So if Jamie Dimon is perceived to be the smartest buyer of financial assets other than, buying. Let's say, Warren Buffett, who's also not buying, why should you? Why should you take that risk? I know people who bought First Republic last week at $80. I know some who bought it last week at $50. I know someone who bought it today at $20. And I'm trying to be nice to these people. And I'm trying to say, what are you doing here? You know what I mean? Like, it just makes no sense. So to me, there's thousands of stocks. Go have a ball. Go buy a bunch that you think have, like, great business models and have technology they're investing in, that have great moats and great managements, and they're not financialized and don't have to be exposed to this. Because I'm just going to tell you this. I mean, I don't know about you guys, but seeing FRC cut in half today and then seeing a stock like Charles Schwab sell off 6.5% from its opening highs after the close, all I know is that I start recalling what it felt like in 2008. Once they got done with one of these things, they started to figure out what's the next one they're going to go for. And I just don't know, in an irrational environment like that, why it makes sense to be a hero. And we're going to talk about the market later here, but I thought the market was absolutely bonkers today. The fact that the S&P and the NASDAQ were up, and then this problem child, not to mention what happened with Credit Suisse and UBS over the weekend, where its equity basically went to zero. This is Credit Suisse. Like, to me, I'm just like, who wants to be a hero and who wants to buy stocks here?
Just let me talk about First Republic for just 1 second. I think that, you know, it opened today, it was down somewhat, but then the story about, are they going to convert their deposits into capital, right? So that clearly is telling you it's not going well, right? And then later on in the day, it seemed like at the end of the day, the story was they're looking for a buyer. I would suspect they've been looking for a buyer for a while, right? And we know that it's not JP Morgan. We know that that at the moment, there doesn't seem to be one, or we would have gotten some inkling of that. So it's right that this one trades just in a, black hole kind of.
So in terms of trading these banks, we know from 2008, we know this from other times in histories where you've had these extreme dislocations, and it was really the bottom in 2009, that they had a very swift rally very swiftly. I think it was 45 days. You saw the BKX rally, 125%. That was off the low. The question is, are we at the low? I'm not sure we know where the low is. And when I think about the stock market here, I think the stock market is rallying for different reasons. And I don't think, bonkers, was that your word?
Yeah.
It's a decent word.
We got Dumbo, bonkers.
I think it's a tangled mess we're in the middle of, because as rates go down, it appears as if there's an opportunity for equities. I just think we're in a dynamic where if you look at peak to trough and the move in the queues into this move and where sentiment is, doesn't surprise me at all. And in fact, it plays into a Fed meeting where I think a dovish hike is something that actually can take equities even higher. And we're seeing that. We're seeing that golden cross in the queues. We're seeing that outperformance. Companies like Apple that are actually trading within 5% of or 10% of their all-time highs is extraordinary, but it's not surprising given where positioning is.
Dovish hike meaning a hike, and then they say no more.
I don't know if they're going to say it just like that, but I think the concept is the banks have tightened financial conditions already for the Fed in the last week. Credit lending is tightening as we speak. So, I don't think it's crazy idea out there that 25 bips is all we got.
I think they shouldn't raise at all. right? They said they're data dependent. We got a lot of data in the last 2 weeks. Maybe right. It wasn't the data we've been thinking of before, but I don't see the harm in I don't know, just waiting. You can maintain your hawkish spin.
Might that instill some fear, though, if you know what I mean?
Like
just about a few weeks ago, the CME
panic.
Fed Tracker tool was pricing a 50 basis point hike. Okay, just like that was literally a few weeks ago, right? And so then it went down to 25, and now what does that say? And again, I think people, for a lot of
we've gotten a little cooler data, though, a little bit of cooler inflation data.
Well, still 6%.
I mean, it's high,
and then
but
let me tell you something. What do you think is going to happen? I'm just going to play my guy Dami here. What do you think is going to happen with rates going lower? It's just going to kind of get some of those inflationary pressures.
We don't want rates to go a lot
up a little bit.
And by the way, you know? 2 years gone from 506 to 63 at the lows this morning. We've had a massive move going into this Fed, so we've priced a lot in.
All right, for more on the banks, let's bring in RBC Capital Markets' Gerard Cassidy. Gerard, great to have you with us. Do you think for the regionals, if you take a look at a regional bank index like the KRE, do you think that we've seen the worst of it stock-wise for this group?
I do think the biggest percent declines have already happened. And as you guys have just been talking about, are we near a bottom? That is the question. And I think we are going to be bottoming here in the next couple of weeks because we all want to see the data from the first quarter. The first quarter data will come out in April, and that's what we want to see, particularly on deposits.
I feel like the big question, though, Gerard, is when you think about the bank, I mean, it's fine to know that we're closer to a bottom, and that's theoretically good, but we don't know what it looks like on the other side in terms of the operating environment, in terms of regulation, et cetera. And so what does your model look like if we don't know those sorts of factors?
I think we should all take into account, similar to past periods when we've gone through a crisis, particularly 08, 09, we know more regulation is coming. So there probably will be lower profitability, but with the sell-off in the stocks, it appears to us that it's overdone, even with the expectation that we'll see lower profitability due to increased regulation over the next couple of years.
Gerard, and I hear you on this, and I think you're right. We're asking that question on when is the low. But I care a lot about your view, the analyst community's view, to the discount rate we're putting on banks, to the unknown, to a world where banks were re-rating over the last 2 years. The payout levels were going higher. The buybacks were going higher. These are all reasons for people to get excited, but also the analyst community to price banks at a different level. What are you doing, or what do you think the community is going to do in the next few months?
I think you're getting right to the point on valuation because you're absolutely right. Following the financial crisis, the valuations dropped and we had to reset. And then what we saw in 2018, when they reached about 1.6 times book and 2.2 times tangible, those were the levels that we aspired to up until very recently. So I think you have to lower those aspiration levels to something because of lower profitability. Maybe we get to 1.4 times book and 1.8 times tangible. But that's the area that I think we're heading toward. But today, it's very tough to see that because of what's going on.
Gerard, just throwing valuation out the window, right? Because maybe it's a moving target, especially when you consider how aggressive rates have been moving in every which direction over the last, call it, few months or so. Do you think there's a potential that we're going to start seeing some of your peers, it doesn't sound like you, maybe say, listen, maybe some of these large money center banks might be prudent to kind of slow down buybacks, cut dividends or suspend them, that sort of thing? Because, I go back and I put my 2008 hat on. I think a lot of these financial institutions probably wish they had kind of slowed down the cash return quicker, okay, not knowing what lies ahead. And so I just think it's just kind of interesting that it's easy to kind of just say this is now ring fence, Europe's kind of ring fence. I just don't really, that page out of that playbook doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
No, I hear you very clearly, and it's an interesting observation. I guess where I would differ somewhat is that unlike 08, 09, or even 1990, those are credit debacles that crushed the banks, force them to cut and eliminate dividends, pull back buybacks. This is an interest rate problem that is really been driven by, of course, Silicon Valley and Signature Bank failures. So I think what you're going to see is that banks know if they maintain the dividends through the next cycle, which is maybe what we're in right now, they will re-rate coming out of the cycle. So dividend cuts is, I think, the last thing they need to do. Plus, they've got strong capital levels today, unlike 07. Plus, they also have plenty of liquidity amongst the biggest banks.
Right, but you just mentioned that this is an interest rate issue, not a credit cycle. On the other side of this, isn't there likely to be greater defaults on the credit side? And I guess that's the one thing. I just find it really interesting that a lot of analysts, a lot of strategists are very dismissive about that because it's different this time, if you will. And I just don't know. Like, we've already seen what's gone on in commercial real estate. There are some defaults. If you look at some of these REITs, these publicly traded REITs, they look like they're in 2009. So I'm just wondering why there's not more focus on what comes on the other side of slower growth. You're starting to see a lot of really interesting institutions, Apollo, one of them, saying they think there's a hard landing coming. If there's a hard landing coming, that comes with defaults.
No, you're right. We're not in the hard landing camp. But if somebody's in the hard landing camp, where unemployment at the worst in a hard landing reaches 8 or 9%, you know, real GDP contracts over 2%, then the banks are really going to have issues with credit. But that being said, if we're in a soft or shallow recession, we're starting from such a strong base that, yes, there will be higher credit costs this year. We have factored in upwards to 100% increase in credit costs this year versus 2022. Now, granted, 2022 was relatively low. But I'd point out on the commercial real estate side, when you look at that more specifically, the biggest banks have not that, the exposure is not that material, unlike it was in 1990 when commercial real estate was a serious problem for the banks. So yes, there will be some issues. I don't disagree with you. The real question is it a hard landing or a shallow recession? In a shallow recession, I think the banks manage through it without too much difficulty.
Gerard, I was just curious what the temperature of your clients are in terms of wanting to actually buy. I mean, I'm wondering if there's any sort of pushback because so many parties, whether it be regulators, whether it be the analyst community, whether it be the ratings agencies, completely missed what was on the books of Silicon Valley Bank, of Signature. And I wonder if there's any doubt about analysis that is being done on Wall Street, if there's an element of we still don't really know what the next thing is going to be, or we don't have a grasp of what the situation is.
It is a very fair question. And I would say that the unknown that was not expected by myself, or I think most of us, was to see a deposit run accelerate so fast through social media and through Twitter. That is what accelerated the deposit run, which now we have to maybe take into account. But what's interesting, too, is that as we go forward, asking, you know, investors, how do they want to position themselves? In talking to our clients, the investors that have been exposed to banks and have suffered here, of course, they are a little hesitant or reticent to get back in. But the investors that didn't have any bank exposure, they're looking very hard and very eager. When do I jump in? Because they see, as you guys mentioned, you look at past cycles, when the stocks hit bottom, on average, they go up anywhere from 75 to 90%. Now, granted, we didn't fall as much this time, so we may not go up as much. But once we get through this storm, it could be an interesting time to own banks.
Gerard, thanks so much. Good to see you. Gerard Cassidy of RBC.
Thank you.
Another unknown, really quick, though, is that look what happened with the UBS and Credit Suisse. You have AT1 debt, which was wiped out, $17 billion for people that thought they were in a different instrument than equity shareholders. So that's the kind of a thing that we just don't know. And this is one of the 30 systemically most important banks. So are these money center banks.
All right. Karen?
I do own banks.
Yeah.
Is that the question?
If there's an element of unknown because of the additional tier one, bonds that are out there that got wiped out. I mean, you think you're on you think you're in line ahead of the equity holders, and you're not, as it turns out.
Right. Well, I don't know that we have those securities here. So I don't own any foreign banks. I own JP Morgan, I own Bank of America, I own Wells Fargo, I own Morgan Stanley. I think that that's where I want to be in the banking sector. I own no regionals.
Will they be bigger?
Yes.
1 year? Will they be bigger through acquisitions?
Well, deposits are already making them bigger.
And more regulated.
And more regulated.
I mean, more people grabbing onto them, for sure.
All right, coming up. Foot Locker gets kicked, shares more than giving back a big gain at the open. So what had investors getting off on the wrong foot? We got the details ahead. But first, more tech layoffs hitting Amazon, the e-commerce giant cutting nearly 10,000 more jobs. What it says about the strength of the jobs market and the tech sector when Fast Money returns.
What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
What does it mean to be rich? Is it having more stories to share or time to give? Is it being able to keep your loved ones close or travel somewhere far away? At Edward Jones, we believe the key to being rich is knowing what counts. Your dedicated financial advisor will take a comprehensive approach to your financial strategy to help support what truly matters to you. EdwardJones.com/findyourrich. Edward Jones, member SIPC.
Welcome back to Fast Money. Amazon extending its job cuts. The e-commerce giant planning to lay off another 9,000 workers, adding to the 18,000 payroll reduction that began in November. Deirdre Bosa's got all the details. Debo.
Hey, Mal. Well, Amazon taking a page from Meta's book and not doing these job cuts once but twice. Andy Jassy, in that announcement, he said that some may ask why we didn't announce these role reductions with the ones we announced a couple months ago. The short answer is that not all the teams were done with their analyses in the late fall, which does beg the question, could we see even more layoffs from some of the other big tech companies like Alphabet, which many investors have said should be cutting more because of the enormous hiring that many of the big tech companies did during the pandemic. Take a look at this. Meta and Amazon hired the most. Amazon more than doubling its workforce. Remember that the jobs that have been cut so far are corporate jobs. Finally, Melissa, I just want to point to one chart, and that is AWS growth, because it was interesting that some of these cuts took place in AWS, the cloud computing business, as well as advertising. These are the profit drivers. These are high-margin businesses. But you can see here that AWS growth has been decelerating. That's expected to fall into the low teens even later this year. Back to you.
Debo, thanks. Deirdre Bosa on Amazon. Dan, you think this continues?
Yeah, I think Debo just made a really good point. I mean, these are like kind of white-collar jobs there, yep. Right? So they really grew in a lot of their logistics and their delivery and all that sort of stuff. I think the fact that you're seeing them in AWS is concerning. I think it just kind of is an acknowledgement that this is going to be the slowest growth for AWS, like probably ever in the 15-year existence in the teens. That being said, they still have, I think, a great deal of market share. And I think there's a lot of, you know, I think they are more exposed to small, medium-sized businesses, though. That's the one thing. And if we do go into a recession and you think about a lot of these tech companies that might be having a difficult time in that sort of environment, then they probably lose some of that business. And if they were to have like high single digits growth in AWS, I mean, that would be not great for this story.
Julie?
Yeah, I mean, if you think just about Amazon, they've added something like 800,000 or 900,000 jobs since the pandemic, right? So it pales in comparison to what everyone is starting to cut now. But it's very important to make note of where those cuts are happening. You know, frontline workers are still pretty critical, and we can't fill those jobs at all. So I think that employment remains very, very stable. The white collar workers, you know, I think of any business that has 4 and 5 social media managers, those are getting consolidated down to 1. And I think that's where that mid-level tier of employment is what's going to feel the biggest hit. And you have to worry about Amazon's business, right? Because so much of the consumer softening is probably going to impact them at the same time as AWS is starting to soften as well. So I think they're exposed on both ends of that.
I think last week we talked 2 nights about a flight to FANG that we were seeing in the markets with the bank turmoil.
Flight to MANG.
Oh, because it's Meta now,
yes,
not Facebook. It
no
doesn't
FANG.
Sound good. Whatever
awful.
It is, you know what I'm talking about. Is that over now? What do you think?
Is the flight over?
Yeah.
I mean, it's been a pretty good run. I'll tell you, the flight's not to Amazon. It's the sentiment in Amazon, I think, is as bad as I've seen it in 5 years. OK, and I look at the cash burn there. They've burned $22 billion over the last couple of years. I actually think that that's a reason to buy the stock. I mean, it's underperformed the S&P by 60% over the last couple of years.
Yeah, I agree. The cash burn is self-inflicted, voluntary.
They could
spend.
Switch that.
They could absolutely slow that down. I do think this Mang Fang run is a little long in the tooth. I did sell some upside Goog calls. I'm hanging on to that and Meta, though. I wouldn't be surprised if they pull back some.
There is a lot more Fast Money to come. Here's what's coming up next.
One foot out the door, the other in red. Shares of Foot Locker dropping after its latest earnings report. It's time to lace up. We're trading the retailer next. Plus, gearing up for what could be the biggest Fed decision of the year. Investors waiting with bated breath on what the central bank will do next. And one major bank is calling for a pause. How all the banking turmoil factors into their move. You're watching Fast Money, live from the NASDAQ market site in Times Square. We're back right after this.
You seek the key, but first, you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today.
Welcome back to Fast Money. Foot Locker stomping on its own gains today, rallying as much as 11% early in the day, but finishing the session down 5.5%. The athletic apparel retailer flaunting a renewed relationship with Nike, but saying sales for the current year would be down 3.5% to 5.5%. FL is the FL in flambé.
Yes, it is. Flambé. It is. What a wild day for both Foot Locker and First Republic. And yet, very different stories, obviously. So Foot Locker, the earnings for last quarter, which they had delayed to do to coincide with the investor day, were very good. That was good. The problem was they had a lot of talk about how they're transforming this company, and it's expensive. So they're doing a lot of things, and I think they're doing the right things. They are closing a lot of stores, a couple of hundred stores that are in B and C malls, and they are opening another couple of hundred stores that are bigger, that are in B and A malls and off mall locations. That's going to cost them a lot of money. They're closing some, they've already actually closed some European stores, but I think that it's a real sort of reset by Mary Dillon. She thinks that their loyalty program is way underutilized, that they have a lot of potential there. She is a loyalty program master, so I'm very interested to see what they can do there. They feel like they have a lot of they could change their mix from more omnichannel, that the omnichannel customer is way more profitable than just someone in store. So they got a lot of things that they laid out. It's going to cost them a lot of money to do it. Their earnings this year aren't going to be great. I think that the guidance was a little disappointing in where they could get to. Putting all of that together, I think there was a sandbag there. Why not? If you're the new CEO and this is your, you know, big coming out party, why put the bar too high? So I have a lot of faith in her. I do think we're going to see very mixed to, I don't know, some negative, some positive from the analysts. It probably will trade down tomorrow. I would look to buy some.
Make you feel better about Nike and DTC?
Well, Nike DTC and they call it their revitalized relationship with Nike. I thought Mary Dillon spoke very positively about the entire sneaker market, which Dan single-handedly probably keeps all these people in business. But nice sleds. But I worry about the multiple we're willing to pay for Nike. And so that to me, in the short run, for a company that I've owned forever and I love, I just don't love it at these prices. And so that's something I think you have to be watchful for tomorrow.
All right. Be sure to catch Jim Cramer's exclusive interview with Foot Locker CEO Mary Dillon. That is tomorrow night on Mad Money right here on CNBC. Meantime, coming up on Fast, crude conundrum. Prices dropping toward the 64-buck mark before rebounding into the close. Stick around to hear why one of the traders thinks energy is totally mispriced at these levels. And is a timeout on the table where your next guest says the Fed needs to take a step back at this week's meeting. More on that when Fast Money returns.
Get your trades to go with the Fast Money podcast. Catch us anytime, anywhere. Follow today on your favorite podcasting app. We're back right after this.
Welcome back to Fast Money. Another check on the markets today. A relief rally for stocks to kick off the week. The Dow jumping 382 points. The S&P climbing nearly 1%. And the Nasdaq Tech Heavy Index trailing, still up nearly 0.5%. Oil prices rebounding after hitting their lowest levels since 2021. Crude dropping to $64 a barrel at one point before bouncing. Energy still the worst performing sector this year. Wow, Tim.
To me, this is just inconsistency in markets. And I think we've seen over the last couple of days, a lot of stocks have behaved like they were regional banks. Oil has behaved that way, too. And I just think you either have oil is overdone or you should be massively selling equities here. You should be selling recession equities, which I don't think you should be doing. So by default, do I say go buy oil? Well, I do think if you look at both China reopening, which second half of 23 is really when we're going to see some demand. There's been no major downgrades in GDP. We all have talked about the impact of what this means on bank lending, et cetera. But no, oil is way overdone. And more importantly, oil equities don't want $100 oil, folks. They don't want 65, but I think we're getting back to 80.
All right. Meantime, the all-important Fed decision just 2 days away. Our next guest wants the Fed to take a step back and end the rate hikes. Peter Bookvar is the chief investment officer at Bleakley Financial Group. He's also a CNBC contributor. Peter, great to have you with us. And it's interesting how quickly, you know, people went from one side of the boat, 50, to the other side of the boat, which is either pause or 25. There is a case, though, to be made, in theory, you know, that regulators have done so much to backstop the financial system, whether it be here in the United States or globally now, given the events over the weekend, that that enables the Fed to keep, you know, pounding at inflation and go ahead with the rate hikes.
I think that's what they're going to do. And it'll be 25. And while Powell's not going to use the word pause, he's going to basically imply a pause and that they'll take a step back and they'll see how things play out. I think from a risk management standpoint, they should be doing nothing. I mean, the world has changed. The world has changed a lot just over the past couple of weeks. And the Fed needs to really start thinking about how things unfold from here. So before the bank turmoil over the last couple of weeks, we've seen the tightest lending standards, not including COVID, in commercial industrial loans since 2009. Commercial industrial loan level in terms of amount outstanding up until the day before it totally unraveled with SVB, it was no higher than December. So the economy is already in motion to the downside. The Fed should at least acknowledge that. And they also have to keep in mind that just keeping rates at an elevated level for a while is its own form of continued monetary tightening.
Peter, it's Karen. I agree with you about what he should do, I think, is zero. But what do you think is the data, since he's data dependent, that he would need to see for, let's say, further lending tightening? Or what other metrics would you look at that they could say, all right, you know, we're starting to see this is pressuring inflation as well, so we're heading in the right direction. We'll stay paused.
Well, unfortunately, a lot of the data he's going to look at is backward looking. We have to assume that at least small and medium-sized businesses are going to dramatically slow the extension of credit to their customers, both households and businesses. As they focus more on their balance sheet, they focus more on dealing with their any bad marks that they have, they deal with potentially raising deposit rates to stem the outflow of deposits. And if you're a loan officer, you're now more interested in not making mistakes than potentially taking some risk and making new loans. So we have to assume where the economy is going to go from here rather than them waiting for data that by the time they see it is going to be relatively old news.
Peter, can you help quantify this? I read this in the book report, your note this morning. You mentioned the C&I loans, so the commercial industrial loans, and specifically as it relates to commercial real estate. And so when you're talking about the exposure that a lot of these regional banks have to those sorts of lending, help us quantify what that means for the economy right here. Like you just mentioned some of these things. Does it really almost ensure that if standards are going to get that much tighter, that we will have a greater slowdown? So it's just amazing. We had Gerard Cassidy on before, and he's not in the hard landing camp. You know what I mean? Like, these guys are still in the soft landing, no landing camp. I just don't know how that happens.
So about 70% of commercial real estate lending comes from small and medium-sized banks. And you can only imagine what they're thinking now in terms of extending new loans that are coming due this year, or the keys that are being handed back to them by office owners that don't want to own the property. Well, you can be sure banks don't want the keys back either. They would love to see a borrower continuing to pay, because what is a bank going to do with this office building? So there's going to and going into the last couple of weeks prior to this, banks were already sort of freezing their participation in commercial loans. And a lot of the commercial loans that were taking place were from non-bank lenders. And you can be sure the non-bank lenders at this point in the cycle are going to be charging double digits to commercial real estate borrowers in terms of interest rates.
So, Peter, we don't often get an outright, you know, buy this or sell this from you, but Would you say that there's more downside for regional banks at this point?
So I think the risk of potential dilution is certainly going to be important on the equity side. But a lot of these banks have gotten really beaten up that I do think that there's going to be some value to be had at some point. And even the biggest banks, we know that they're going to be a beneficiary of how this plays out. But I think sort of the super regionals is where investors need to look at some point. But we know it's good to buy the banks when they're trading around book value. And now over the next coming quarters, there's a good chance that book value starts to fall as banks remark a lot of their assets. But anything, a good bank that's trading at book value or less is going to be attractive at some point over the next couple of quarters.
Peter, always great to get your take. Thanks. Peter Brookvar.
Thanks, Melissa.
Does it matter? Of course it matters. If the Fed does 25 and then sort of says enough, or if the Fed does nothing and then keeps a hawkish tilt, does that nuance matter?
The nuance is all that matters. I think the Fed needs to keep people on their toes, and I think they're going to try to do that. I think they still have, you know, their most important mandate that's left is certainly inflation. I look back to where we are. We're pricing in 75, 80 bips of price cuts on Fed fund futures. By the way, last week, Rick Santelli told us not to take that as gospel. So he's absolutely right. They move all over the place, but that's where positioning is right now, and that's where that nuance is important.
Is a pause, Julie, going to cause panic? Is a pause going to say, oh, my gosh, things are going awry and we don't have a good handle on it and we got to stop?
It's hard to say, right? I that's how I would interpret it. I would interpret it as pretty negative, right? And they have access to some of the data that we don't as far as what's really under the hood at some of these banks. And the other thing that always concerns me is that recessions that are triggered by a financial crisis tend to be much deeper and harder to get out of, right? Because there's no lending that's really happening. And not, you know, we can sit here and say, look, this isn't being triggered by, you know, poor quality credit, but we have to think about, you know, 0% interest rates for more than a decade, and we think there's going to be no repercussions from that. We really think that all that credit quality is phenomenal. I don't know. I really worry about that longer term. And so, you know, I think if they're at zero, to me, that signals, uh-oh, maybe there's more that we don't really understand that could be coming down the pipe.
100%. I think it's ludicrous to think that these major money center banks don't have similar mismatches as far as maturities. You say no.
I say no.
I will bet you, guaranteed. Guaranteed. Think about since you've been in this business, okay, yeah. When there's free money to be had, or when people think that there's free money, or there's some sort of spread, there's some sort of trade on, they all do
there
it.
There we go.
They all do it. And all of these banks are going to be forced to be really transparent. You know why? Because all these major money center bank CEOs, they're on speed dial with the White House, they're on speed dial with the Treasury, they're on speed dial with the FTC, and there's no hiding this sort of stuff.
Them being on speed dial with whoever doesn't mean they're taking duration risk. I don't know why you equate those two things. They're irrelevant to me.
Okay, well, we'll see. I mean, I'm just saying I have no knowledge of it.
Look at the 10-K. You'll have some knowledge.
I think there's duration risk.
I don't think there's duration risk. And we're remotely close to what you're saying. If you look at SVB's books, the 10-year plus duration risk there, some of which is mortgage-backed securities, which we know the duration gets longer, and Tim talked about that a week or two ago, it's nowhere remotely close to what J.P. Morgan's is. And if you look at J.P. Morgan's deposits and you look what's coming in, look at their 10-K.
Okay, well, let's see what the marks look like. We do know
from the FDIC chairman that at the end of 2022, unrealized losses were $620 billion.
Yes.
I mean, is it fair to say it's $620 billion is not just Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank?
Correct, but what is the denominator of that, right? And rates have moved a little bit the other way since then. And if you look at if you marked to market, the held to maturity, mm-hmm. the change at J.P. Morgan would actually be the smallest, pretty small on an absolute basis, and way smaller than all of the other G-SIB banks.
I would agree with the denominator part, except that it's not spread across banks. It is concentrated, and we've seen what just a couple of blowouts.
But what is the denominator of assets?
Okay.
I mean, it's at least $11 trillion if you're saying it's just G-SIBs.
Right, but that didn't help.
But you're also saying no hedge. You're saying no hedge.
If they hedge,
that is not correct.
If they hedge, though, okay, it's my understanding, if they hedge those books, then they have to take those marks, okay? And so my point is they might not have taken the marks just yet because they haven't had a run on their assets, Karen. So, like, that's my point. And if anything, they've taken in a lot more assets. So, like, listen.
They've taken a lot more assets right now, which are just deposits and
cash. We could have been arguing the same way in mid-March of 2008, what kind of, like, was going on with Bear and some of the run that was on, you know, and we could have been saying, no, all these other peers were not doing some of the same stuff, did not have the same exposure. That would have been a really bad
bet. Oh, you're really going to play
Switzerland? Can I be Switzerland? Because Switzerland's been in the news, and they're there to protect their banking sector, so I'm here to protect you guys. I just think that there's two points that are being made. I'll echo your most important point of the day, which is that credit is still out there. Oh. Credit is lurking. Karen's point is very clear. Very different balance sheets, very different approach to their lending business, and not even close in terms of the risk. They're not in the business to take that kind of risk. So welcome to the Europe. Welcome to the European Union. Nice to be. Yes.
It's funny that you say that because a bank like J.P. Morgan has made tremendous inroads in investment banking. How do they do that? Okay, how do they do that? They do that with a whole host of other products and services, the same business model that Silicon Valley Bank was in to win a lot of those same mandates and those same customers. So what I'm saying is we just don't know, right? We don't know. And I don't know. It just doesn't seem that compelling to me.
We got to go.
All right.
We're just getting going.
All right. Thank you for playing Switzerland. I do appreciate that.
Look,
I
was just going to come in and just
blow whistle or something.
World.
Coming up, one options trader making a big bet that all the intervention and all the efforts to save First Republic Bank may all be for naught. The trade and the action straight ahead. Fast Money's back in two. Welcome back to Fast Money. First Republic shares dropping more than 47% today, despite sources telling CNBC's David Faber that J.P. Morgan is advising the struggling bank. Options traders betting that it could be the next domino to fall. Mike Coe's got the action. Mike?
Yeah, it traded more than five times its average daily options volume, puts outpacing calls, the busiest of those all expiring at the end of this week, and the busiest put contract were the five strike puts. We saw over 68,000 of those trading for 40 cents. Buyers of those puts are either betting on or hedging against. Much more bad news for the stock by the end of the week.
All right. Thank you, Mike Coe. For more options action, tune into the full show Friday, 5:30 p.m. Eastern time. Coming up, auto inventory is on the rise. What does the rising stock of cars mean for car stocks? Stick around. We're taking a road trip to the car lot. That's next on Fast Money. Welcome back to Fast Money. Automakers have been ramping up production this year, and that's got new vehicle lots filling up. But will this prompt dealers to up incentives to get their inventories moving? Let's bring in Phil LeBeau for more on this. Phil.
Melissa, we are at a bit of a crossroads for the auto industry as they edge back towards normal, and normal being pre-pandemic, pre-supply chain chip shortages. And let me show you those numbers again that you just showed. The inventory of new vehicles, and we're talking about retail new vehicles, what we see at dealerships, it's 41 days supply, up 49% compared to July when it hit its low point of 26 days supply, according to J.D. Power. And from their perspective, a normal market would be 60 to 70 days supply. At the same time, look at this chart. This says it all in terms of what people are paying at the dealership. Average transaction price, it did pull back a little bit in February. We'll see what we get for March, but it's still pretty darn close to an all-time high at just under $49,000. The incentive, meanwhile, has moved up. Highest level it's been in a year, up to $1,474 per vehicle, which creates an interesting situation for the automakers. And we're talking about GM, Ford, Toyota, the guys who are still building a lot of internal combustion engine vehicles and sending them out to the dealers or selling them to the dealers who then sell them to you and I. What happens if we continue to see this inventory move higher? This is an industry with a bad track record of showing discipline because all it takes is one or two automakers to say, keep pumping, keep moving the metal, and then you see the incentives move higher. For the auto dealers, it's an interesting time. They still have fairly limited inventory, but that is expected to change this summer. Melissa, I'll be curious to see what happens as we move through the next couple of months for the traditional automakers, because 2 years ago, nobody was talking about inventory. You know what they were talking about? EV investment. We're going to be in EVs by 25, 26. This is the money we'll be making. That's still an important story, but you can't forget the legacy business.
Yep. Phil, thanks. Phil LeBeau.
You bet.
Up next, Final Trades. We were just talking to Phil about the rising inventories and perhaps seeing incentives go higher. We've seen this before. Julie, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we're going to continue, right? And if we are still at a place where inventory days are shorter than they have been historically, I'm a big believer in regression to the mean. So I don't think we're going to see it looking any better anytime soon.
All right. It's time for the final trade. Let's go around the horn. Oh, we'll go back to Julie. Julie.
You know, big fan of durable earnings with all of this tumult. So Ansys is a company, good software business, reliable.
Tim Seymour.
Well, in terms of reversion of the mean, Google to the triple Qs or the NASDAQ 100, it's actually breaking out and it had underperformed significantly, now above the 200. Google.
Chairwoman.
Yes. So if hard landing, soft landing, whatever, if there's some kind of landing, recession, I still think that consumer spends and TJX might be where they're going to do it.
A lot of bargains there for fashionistas. Dan?
My mom loves to.
So do I.
I'm a seller of the XLF. That might surprise you guys, but I think it's going to make lower lows in the not too distant.
All right. Thanks so much for watching Fast. We'll see you back here tomorrow at 5 for more Fast Money. Meantime, do not go anywhere. A CNBC special Taking Stock with John Fort starts right now.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. FedEx Ground service is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.